and Delta Pavonis would probably be next, and they were good candidates. I checked the archives just on the off chance. No such luck. No one had visited those systems yet, although a couple of Bobs were heading for them as part of Mario's scouting. I got up and started pacing around my office, then I pinged Mario and he popped over. What's up? Mario, the others just moved again, this time heading for NN4285. Yeah, I saw that. Not a prime system. Still, we have to figure out how to nip this in the bud. I'm concerned about the Pavonis candidates. Do you have an ETA for them? Gamma and Delta? Claude and Jacques are heading for those. Claude will be at Gamma in about a month and Jacques at Delta in 22 months or so. Damn it! The closest significant presence we've got is Sol, and we can't divert them from building colony ships. Epsilon Indy? No, Epsilon Indy is too far away as well, although closer than Sol, but resources are poor, and colonists to KKP will be too busy setting up to help. Mario nodded. He looked down at his toes for a few milliseconds, then turned and glared at me. What is it with the Pavonis systems that's giving you a pickle up your butt anyway? I sighed and stopped pacing. I favored Mario with a self-conscious smile. Call it a premonition. Call it superstition. Call it utter faith in the power of Murphy. Based strictly on distance, those two are among the next likely targets. Based on the star's types, they're good, habitable planet candidates. Based on our experience so far, most good systems with a planet in the right place have life. Not intelligence, necessarily, but life. I shrugged, letting Mario make the connection. He was silent for a few moments, thinking. On the other hand, they've just sent out an expedition to NN4285, and the GL-54 expedition hasn't made it back to their home system. How many armadas do you suppose they have? Fair point. They don't seem to have any real sense of urgency. I wonder how long a prime lives. So look, Bill, why don't you build a group here and send it to the area? I shook my head. Too far. I'll do it if there's no other way. We need to get an inventory of what Bobs are in what systems so we can figure out what response is possible. Mario gave me a nod and popped out. I pinged Claude. His return indicated he was down to a low tau, about 0.03. That wouldn't affect communications at all and was hardly worth adjusting frame rates for. He was open for company, so I popped in. Hey, Bill. Claude. I looked around at his VR. Not particularly anything. Tropical beach, cabana, deck chair. Could be Mexico, Hawaii, or some made-up location. I didn't have any memories of a vacation like this, so I assumed the last option. Claude was looking at me with slightly wide eyes. He was a generation removed from me, and it was funny how the Bobiverse was becoming hierarchical like that. I materialized a deck chair of my own and sat down. Been following the others, Claude? Yeah, I was at the moot and I heard about NN4285. Okay. So here's the thing. With the others taking out GL-54, there's no Bob-controlled system anywhere close to you. When you get to Gamma Pavonis, you have to assume you only have a couple of decades at most before the others come visiting. You're going to have to mobilize for war, essentially. Claude frowned. A lot of assumptions in there. Not as many as you'd think, and the assumptions are high probability. Claude sighed and resettled himself in his chair to face me squarely. Look, Bill, I get the whole thing about the others, and they're evil, blah, blah, but why here and why now? Why this particular line in the sand? I'll grant you there's nothing unique about Gamma Pavonis to the limit of our current knowledge, but we have to start somewhere. Maybe we won't be ready for them in time. Maybe they'll swoop down on you in a decade and you'll have to flee like Mario did. But at some point, we have to try. Why not here and why not now? Claude gave me a wry smile. Because here and now puts me in the crosshairs, thank you very much. I laughed. Well, that's why God invented backups. I popped back to my own VR after extracting a promise from Claude that he'd get the system report on Gamma Pavonis to me on a priority basis. I checked Jacques' tau, but he was still way up there. A conversation would take days, even if he frame-jacked. I quickly went down my list of known manufacturing centers. There weren't a lot, Most Bobs didn't bother in most systems other than building a space station. I remembered Bart, who was the last Bob that I'd talked to in Alpha Centauri. I sent a quick ping to him, but it looked like he was between systems. Bart's acknowledgement indicated a ridiculous tau. I'd be a few days even waiting for a response, never mind a conversation. I queried the Alpha Centauri space station directly. The status report appeared in front of me in a window. Garfield came around and looked over my shoulder. "No one there right now," he said. "Looks like the last group left it uninhabited." "Well, we can't force anyone to stay and play caretaker. It's a free galaxy." I ran a hand through my hair, then stopped and looked at my hand. That was Riker's tick. I didn't need to start that. "It looks like a full-power Amy, though. If I can get it to build a replicant matrix, I can load my backup and the new me can bootstrap up from there." "You're going to load a backup across interstellar distances with no Bob overseeing? Wow, dude." I shrugged. "No difference in principle. I'll checksum the hell out of it before approving it for load." I thought for another millisecond, then nodded. "I don't have a choice anyway. We can't afford to ignore any potential source of Bobs. I'm afraid, like it or not, we're going to war." 60. Arrival. Claude, May 2205, Gamma Pavonis. Gamma Pavonis was an F8V class of star, which made it slightly bigger and barely hotter than Sol. The effect was a system with a comfort zone slightly farther out, but a sun that would look virtually indistinguishable from ours. I paradoxically found myself hoping that I wouldn't find anything in the comfort zone. The whole dialogue with Bill had left me freaked out and ambivalent about what I might find. I would actually feel better if there was nothing in this system worth defending. Well, you have to know that Murphy is listening for just exactly that kind of wish so he can give you the shaft. The planet sat at just over 100 million miles out, a gorgeous, shining blue and green marble with bands and swirls of white, orbited by one larger moon and three smaller ones. Damn. I went immediately into orbit to determine if it included intelligent life. That would be a real kick in the pants. Fortunately, the planet failed, or passed, depending on attitude, the first obvious tests. There was no radio traffic, no web of exhaust trails in the atmosphere, no satellites, and no sprinkle of lights on the night side. That still left pre-industrial civilization, of course, but that would require a closer look. I sent a quick email off to Bill with results so far, then deployed the exploration drones. Mario had decided that the latest version Heaven vessels would come with enough onboard assets so that we could investigate a system quickly. This meant mining and manufacturing operations could wait for later. The drones took up polar orbits for a couple of passes, then swooped into atmosphere to check out interesting items. I spent 5 days on observation and exploration. I didn't want to screw this up, but finally, I felt confident enough to report my findings. No intelligence, thank God. But the ecosystem was as rich and varied as anything in Earth's history. This was a planet with everything stacked in its favor. The right size, the right distance from a sun with good solar output but relatively low UV, good-sized moons, plate tectonics active enough to ensure consistent surface recycling, the list went on and on. This was an ideal colony target, except for the part where it was on the other's front porch. Now I would have to move to phase two. This system actually had a relatively low metallicity, at least according to the star's spectral lines. Perhaps that was why the others had rejected it in favor of the slightly more distant NN4285. But the next star out, GL902, was over 2 light-years farther than this one. I doubted the others would bypass it again. Well, low metallicity was a relative term. I was sure I'd still find more than enough resources for my purposes, even if it took a bit of work to find. There was a ping from Bill, then he popped in. "Hey, Claude, I've been looking over your report. Sounds like a great planet." And that's the problem. It is a great planet, great system. And if you're right, due to be harvested sometime in the next, what, 100 years? Bill looked down for a moment. Mario has been getting reports back from Bob's hitting surrounding systems. Combined with his own observations in Zeta Toucani and Beta Hydri, we're able to make a rough estimate of a system every 10 to 20 years. So they've only been at this maybe 100 years? We don't know how long they were working only within their system. It might have taken them 100 years to get started. Maybe the first out-system harvest taught them a lot. Anyway, the point is, there are a lot of unknowns before they started regularly harvesting. Bill had popped up a star chart while he was talking, the various star systems flashing a tooltip as he mentioned them. Jacques will be arriving at Delta Pavonis in 18 months. The positions of Delta Pavonis and GL-877 are about the same distance from you, so if we see the others head your way, anything he launches from Delta will arrive here at the same time. So, hopefully, you'll have reinforcements. I nodded. That was something, anyway. 61. Starting over. Oliver. September 2205. Alpha Centauri. HIC-71683-14. Damn, I'm not Bill anymore. Now I need a new name. This had happened to me once before as one of Bob One's first cohort in Epsilon Eridani. Now, I was a noob again, this time in Alpha Centauri. I popped into Bill's VR. I hate you. Bill grinned at me. Nah, you know the rules. New name, dude. ASAP. Oliver, in keeping with the Bloom County theme. Bill nodded his approval. Oliver was a fun character, and we'd liked him. One advantage of this arrangement, I guess, is that I know the whole plan already. Bill laughed and nodded. Saves time. I stood up. So, I'll get to it. I may set up in competition with you, though. Want to bet I get FTL first? I'd be overjoyed if you did, Oliver. Everyone wins. I waved to Bill and popped back home. Both Alpha Centauri A and B had reasonable resource levels. Bart and crew had concentrated their efforts in A, but I needed to get things rolling quickly. It would be 6 months until my vessel was ready. At that point, I would start the auto factory in Alpha Centauri A to building Bob's on a crash basis, while I would fly over to Alpha Centauri B with another auto factory and set up there as well. At the top acceleration of a version 4 vessel, it was less than a 4-day trip. Meanwhile, I would have to consider possible weapons against the others. Busters could pass through the cargo ships or death asteroids multiple times and do little or no detectable damage. Nukes were effective, and the expedition to 82 Eridani had yielded some good information. We didn't have time to figure out fission weapons from scratch. I regretted, a little, not having worked on that before, but only a little. Plasma spikes like busters were simply too small, not effective against the mega monster ships we would be going up against. I needed either a large mass, a large explosion, or a lot of energy. Heat energy, electrical energy, gravitational, or momentum. Relativistic velocities. How fast could I accelerate things? Hands behind my back, muttering in thought, I retired to my new mad science lab. I really had no idea what size of force I was going to need. However, there was very little downside to overdoing it and a lot of downside to the converse. With that thought in mind, I decided to just go for everything I could manage. Taking a lesson from Bob One's experience, I decided I would start by doubling my production capability. Accordingly, my first production run consisted entirely of new printers. I then assigned a couple of printers to do nothing but produce more printers while the rest started working on drones. I was going to invest some upfront time in ramping up my capacity, which would hopefully pay off later. It took almost 2 years before I was ready to start building actual Bobs. The speed at which a printer could produce an item was dependent partly on the size of the item, but also very much on the level of detail required. 3D printers delivered individual atoms using a number of tuned carbon nanotubes, each sized for specific elements. Building something like itself required the maximum level of detail and precision, as you had to place individual carbon atoms one after another with zero defects. This made 3D printers one of the most complex items that a 3D printer could be asked to build. Only something biological would be harder. Anyway, finally, I was producing Bobs. After much discussion, Bill and I came up with a blueprint for a version 5 Heaven vessel, a virtual dreadnought compared to the original Heaven 1. I felt a little intimidated just looking at the plans. Bill was still working on the Sudar cloaking from the 82 Aridney mission, but we knew enough about it to build around the requirement for now. I also put together a design for a stealth buster, very similar in overall structure to Medeiros's stealth fission bombs. Howard had managed to extract H-bomb blueprints from Butterworth. I guess the colonel considered the others to be enough of a threat to override military secrecy. Unbelievable that they were still even thinking in those terms with 99.9% of the human race gone. 3 years after waking up at Alpha Centauri, I had my first cohort of battle cruisers. 62. Departure. Mulder, November 2201. Departure. I put my hands behind my head and stretched as I reviewed the report that I would be sending to Bill and Riker. This would be my final report from Poseidon. Tomorrow, Monty would start the return trip to Earth, empty except for some biological samples, and I would point my bow and head for a new system, leaving Marcus as Bob in residence here. I pinged Monty and Marcus and invited them over. They responded immediately. "Hey, Mulder, I'm going to miss you guys," Marcus said, looking at each of us. "Yeah, I know," Monty replied. "I wish I could keep it down below 0.75C, but we can't afford the extra transit time for a colony ship." Marcus looked a little down, so I gestured to my report to change the subject. "Things are looking good. 3 mat colonies in full operation and 2 floating cities getting close to complete." Marcus nodded. "And as of today, it's 3 months since the last Kraken attack. Apparently they can be taught." Marcus grinned and invoked a Coke. "And then there's this." He popped up an image. "What the f—" I squinted at the graphic. "Is that actually Aerial City, as in floating in the air?" "Yep." He waved a hand. "Well, okay, it's a small proof of concept prototype, but still, I've been putting this thing together for a while. Triple redundancy, all kinds of fail-safes. Theoretically, we should be able to lift something as big as your floating cities and keep it in the air indefinitely."
"Unbelievable," Monty said. "When will it be ready to test?"
Marcus grimaced. "Sorry, buddy. Not for another 6 months. You won't be able to find out the results until you get back to Earth."
"Well, that sucks."
"On the other hand, by the time I'm back online, the thing might be ready for prime time. This could get interesting." I nodded, not saying anything. This was a good argument for staying below 0.75 just to be able to follow the project. If this crazy idea of Marcus's actually worked, it would change the game significantly. Poseidon receded rapidly in the rear view as I accelerated out of the system. The goodbyes from Chief Draper and the friends that I'd made over the years stung more than I'd expected. It was very possible that some of those people would be dead by the time my Tau dropped at the other end. Making friends with humans just didn't seem like a good idea, on balance. Riker pinged me and I invited him in.
"Hey, Mulder. Sorry I couldn't get back to you before. It's been that kind of millennium."
Will grinned at me.
"Especially the last week or so, I guess," I replied, smiling back. I summoned Jeeves and he arrived with a coffee for Will.
"So what's the status back at Sol?" I asked him.
"We have 14 colony ships in active service now," he replied. "Colonies at or soon to be at Vulcan, Poseidon, Epsilon Indy, and 82 Aridney. Things are looking up."
"Or would be if not for the others."
Will sighed. "Yeah, I know. 82 Aridney and Epsilon Indy in particular are close enough to be potentially in danger. We're working on it."
"Yep, just when you start to get ahead in the rat race, the universe delivers bigger rats."
63. The Pav. Jacques, February 2207, Delta Pavonis.
I looked down from orbit at the sprinkles of light decorating the dark side of Delta Pavonis IV, realizing that there was a good chance these beings would be dead soon. Well, Deltans was taken. Pavonians? No, that sucked. Pav, for now, I guess. The Pav appeared to be well into their industrial age, probably equivalent to the Victorian era on Earth. They were pumping smoke into the atmosphere at a prodigious rate, setting the earliest stages for global warming. I sincerely hoped that in the fullness of time they'd have the opportunity to get all bent out of shape about environmentalism. I finished my initial survey, packaged up the results, and fired it off to Bill. It took about 10 minutes before I got a ping, and Bill appeared in my VR. Well, this sucks. I nodded. Remember the days when we thought finding intelligence would be a good thing? I leaned forward and put my head in my hands. And I could end up being witness to the massacre of an entire species. Bill materialized in an Adirondack chair, a little anachronistic in my VR, but whatever, and sat down. He sat in silence for a few milliseconds before replying, Jacques, it's very likely that Gamma will get hit first. That's a full planetary ecology, but at least Claude hasn't found any sentient life. And if the others head that way, you'll be able to help. Meanwhile, you need to start working the system and concentrate on building a bunch of Oliver's dreadnoughts. I looked at him and shook my head. No. Well, yes, but also no. I'll build dreadnoughts and I'll be ready to help Claude, but I'm also going to try to build a couple of colony ships using Riker's design. With the experience he's gained, I should be able to complete them in half the time. If the others come a-knocking, I want to get some Pav off-planet. I'm not going to sit by while an entire race gets blown away. Bill stared at me, frowning for several milliseconds. Then a smile slowly formed. I can't decide if you're brilliant or a moron. I'll think about it. It's definitely a noble idea, Jacques, but maybe not doable. I think we're due for a moot. Maybe we should run it through the group consciousness. I shrugged. The group could talk all they wanted. I knew what I had to do. Bill nodded to me and vanished. Regardless of whether I went with Bill's plan or mine, the first step was the same. Find resources, build Autofactory. This system was metal-heavy, so I didn't anticipate any kind of problem. I turned to Guppy, who was waiting in parade rest, as usual. Funny, even several generations and versions away from Heaven 1, Guppy really hadn't changed. Same fish-headed, deadpan, taciturn sidekick, but he got the job done. Guppy, we need Autofactories, and soon. Send out everything we have to look for locations. Top priority, and don't be subtle. Guppy nodded and went into command fugue. The ship shuddered as a cloud of scouts and drones took off in all directions. I was glad we were past the days when I'd have to personally fly the system with Sudar ranging in all directions. The improvements to Sudar and to the Amys meant that even that part of the process could be delegated. The Order hadn't included the planetary exploration scouts, as those would be useless for that task, and they were already planet-side anyway. I began to draw out a plan for concerted and organized accrual of information about the Pav. The Pav looked, for all the world, like giant meerkats. They stood 6 feet tall or so when upright. They could walk bipedally, but for any kind of distance, they went down on all fours. I was having a little trouble getting used to the sight. Apparently, I'm a bipedalism bigot. Who knew? The Pav wore clothing, but seemingly less for protection or modesty than for decoration and pockets, except in very cold climates. They were organized into countries or states and seemed to use forms of government very similar to what humanity had come up with. Even their societies looked familiar. About the only real difference was the almost complete absence of monogamy. Pav seemed to organize into families of up to 8 adults, generally evenly divided between genders. This created a somewhat different standard design for residences, but otherwise didn't seem to have a large effect on society as a whole. I picked one of the countries that resembled early America, selected one of the larger cities, and settled in for some dedicated research. The absence of electronic media made for a bit of an inconvenience. However, I did find several bookstores. I managed to sneak in a couple of roamers late in the evening. They took up positions in the shadows of the rafters and waited for closing time. Then they started going through books. There wasn't anything like a children's section, but there were books for beginning readers with illustrated alphabets. It took 2 nights to go through the entire contents of the stores. Because a significant portion of the population was still illiterate, there were clubs set up where a PAV would read aloud from a book while patrons ate or drank. Seemed like a very civilized idea to me. I stationed drones in the shadows of every reading club I could find and made a point of scanning the books that were read at my earliest opportunity. Within a month, I had a working vocabulary of the language of this country. The inhabitants, who called themselves Jientfen, spoke a language that they called Tinoje. Meanwhile, the mining scouts found more than enough resources to get going. As expected, this was a rich system. As with many star systems, an asteroid belt sat to the inside of the first Jovian, and the pickings were beyond easy. I set the printers to producing more printers first. I think we'd all learned a lesson from Bob. Early reproduction of printers paid off in the long term. I would wait for the Bob moot and hope that they'd have good suggestions for manufacturing allocations, but if their suggestions didn't include colony ships to get some PAV off-planet, well, they could go jump. 64. Moot. Bill, March 2207, Epsilon Eridani. The air horn's blast brought the usual expressions of appreciation. I couldn't bring myself to grin at the antics, though. This was going to be a tough meeting. The looks on everyone's faces showed that they understood this. Okay, guys, let's summarize. The others have kicked Mario out of GL-54, and they're busily stripping the resources. They've launched another expedition heading for NN-4285. I've expressed concern that Gamma and Delta Pavonis are going to be next. And, oh, look, there's a habitable planet in one system and a civilization in the other. I looked at the sea of faces. Everyone was totally focused on my words. Oliver in Alpha Centauri has come up with a latest and greatest battle wagon design. He's too far away to help Jacques and Claude, though, unless the others hold off a lot longer than I really expect. Jacques is prepared to send reinforcements for Claude, if it comes to that. Or the other way around, if necessary. I looked for the owner of that comment. It was Jacques. I raised my eyebrow at him in an invitation to continue. Delta's farther away from GL-877, so from that point of view, Gamma is a more likely target, except the Delta has way higher metallicity, as can be seen plainly in the spectral lines. Maybe the others will skip the closer system for the better system. They already bypassed Gamma once. I closed my eyes for a moment. An undercurrent of muttering passed through the room. It's a point, Jacques. We won't know until they move. We have full coverage around GL-877 now, so we can see any departures. I motioned to Garfield, who was standing to one side of the podium. Garfield will give us a rundown on weapons capability. Garfield stepped forward and gave an aborted wave to the crowd. He wasn't in the mood either. We have fission bombs, thanks to Medeiros. We have fusion bombs, or at least the plans, thanks to the USE and Colonel Butterworth. We've been able to size up the plasma spikes somewhat, but there's a practical limit to the size of the magnetic containment. We've probably reached that. It's enough for the smaller others' vessels, but not enough to seriously harm the death asteroids or cargo vessels. Garfield popped up a diagram. We've got the basic concepts of the cloaking figured out, but we weren't able to salvage enough hardware to see how the Brazilians were actually doing it. Which means we're starting from scratch. This appears to have been another one of those accidental discoveries, so it's not just a matter of hours thrown at the problem. We're going to need some breakthroughs. Someone at the front commented, without the cloaking, we can't get the bombs close enough to be effective. They'll just zap them or shoot them down. I think it's safe to assume the others have things like missiles as well. We can get the items close enough, someone else responded, if we transport them in the cargo hold of a battle wagon. There was silence as everyone looked at each other. We all knew what that meant. The battle wagon would be destroyed in the explosion as well. We could put Amy's in some battle wagons and make them suicide bombers. I felt my eyebrows climb up my forehead. That was actually not completely idiotic. We'd have to think about how many dreadnoughts we'd staff with Amy's, though. Or scut-based remotes. I looked around. Okay, who is that? Those are some good ideas. Maybe you should be on the committee.
Someone stepped forward. It was Elmer.
No, thanks. I'm just trying to spare my hide. He grinned around at the audience, and we finally got some laughter.
There's also relativistic ramming, another voice interjected. I shook my head.
We thought about that. It would have to be busters or something that could be directed, and even so, you'd have to launch weeks before the encounter, and you'd have to plan it to intercept the enemy at the right place and the right time. Chances of getting it right are too low. Plus, they'll see the approach from a light hour out with Sudar, and they just have to dodge. The busters would have a ridiculous tau and wouldn't be able to react quickly enough. If we forget about relativistic speeds and just stick to our normal ramming, they won't even feel it. Or they'll just zap ship busters a couple of dozen at a time with those big zappers. There was a short silence as everyone digested this. We knocked around the weapons issue for a while, but soon realized we were all rehashing the same information. I ended the meeting, and we broke into groups. Technically, this was the social part of the get-together, but we've always been a workaholic. Each small crowd turned into a single-issue discussion group. In one group, Jacques was doing an informal presentation on the PAV. I found Bob. Bob One, that is, in the audience. I stepped up beside him. He nodded an acknowledgement and turned back to the presentation. I wanted to say something to him about the Deltons, to commiserate or express sympathy, see how he was doing. Something. He was effectively banished from their society. He'd pretty much adopted the tribe as his family, and to be cast out like that couldn't be easy. But, you know, we are Bob, smart, driven, and socially inept. I focused my attention on the presentation. The PAV seemed, in many ways, to be very human. Okay, they were furry, they had group marriages and ran around on all fours, but other than that, the PAV tended to a sort of natural socialism. They had social institutions for the less fortunate, but those seemed to be supported by private funding. And well supported, too. PAV governments, even the types that on Earth would have been heavily interventionist, tended to be lean and hands-off. On the other hand, the PAV were, by human standards, about as organized as a basket of puppies. I wondered what effect introducing Robert's Rules of Order would have on them. Jacques finished his presentation, got a round of applause, then the questions started. I grinned, nodded to Bob, and wandered off. So many Bobs. So much intelligence in this room, if I did say so myself. So much control of resources spread over a sphere that might be approaching 100 light years in diameter. And we couldn't pin together a plan to protect a single planet. With a grimace of self-loathing, I popped back to my own VR. 65. Grandpa. Bob. January 2195, Delta Eridani. Archimedes hovered like a nervous father as Belinda cleaned up her new pup. Buster smiled at him, but I could see an edge of irritation as well. It's the sacred duty of every parent to drive their kids crazy, especially when they become grandparents. I grinned at the thought of my mother and father as grandparents, doing their best to make Andrea and Elena insane. Then I had to wipe my eyes as the thought brought back a cascade of family memories. A quick frame jack allowed me to get it together without missing anything. Belinda handed the pup to her mother-in-law and started cleaning herself. Diana rocked the baby for a few moments, very likely another universal, then smiled at Archimedes. It was a picture postcard moment, if you could ignore the bat ears and pig snouts and fur. And I wanted more than anything I'd wanted in a long time to be able to share in it. Archimedes and Buster would have been fine, but Diana would go screeching to the elders at the first sign of a drone. Damn, I disliked her. In his 40s now, Archimedes still showed exceptional good health. He was, of course, the first generation of Deltons to grow up with the improved nutrition that the Bob's inventions had brought to the tribe, but even so, he seemed to be aging slowly for a Delton. I thought of pestering Bill again about the androids, but he had so many projects on the go, not the least of which was the terraforming of Ragnarok. Bill was good-natured about it, but I had to believe that I was being a bit of a pain. Just the same, he said he was close.
a decade or two at most. It just wasn't a priority. I suppose I could offer to help out, but realistically the Deltons and the armaments project still occupied most of my time. And anyway, no one likes a kibitzer. I pulled out of the surveillance drone and picked another that was spying on Caerleon, the new Delton village. Caerleon was situated in another of the old abandoned village sites, not surprising since whatever made it a good location the first time would still hold true. With the reduction in gorilloid populations and alteration in gorilloid behavior, the village was a good deal safer now. I smiled sadly at the thought. That was the result of my efforts, and they couldn't take that away from me. Caerleon sat at the top of a rise, barely classifiable as a hill, but the thin soil prevented trees from growing there, resulting in a nice, open space, good for living and easy to defend. I found myself constantly worried, though, about relations between Caerleon and Camelot. The establishment of the second village had been peaceful in that no one got stabbed on the way out, but the acrimony had been strong and tensions still ran high between the two villages. It boggled my mind that so soon after almost becoming extinct, the Deltons had managed to develop into some kind of Cold War mentality. The real problem seemed to be that most of the residents of Caerleon were in the adolescent age range and apparently felt a need to prove something. The antagonism of the Caerleon Deltons concerned me enough, in fact, that I'd set up a surveillance system that would warn me if a significant number of them started a march on Camelot. I was probably just being paranoid, though. I hoped. 66. It's happening. Bill, January 2208, Epsilon Eridani.
Others convoy detected.
Not good. This was probably it. The others would be heading for Gamma Pavonis to strip it down, leaving a dead planet and an empty system. Okay, Guppy, details?
Convoy is twice the size of the GL-54 convoy. Projected destination is Delta Pavonis.
Delta Pavonis? That can't be right. Confirm that, please, Guppy.
Convoy trajectory is pointed directly at Delta Pavonis. Barring an unexpected course correction, certainty is 100%.
Son of a bitch, the Pav. I sent a quick email to Jacques in Delta Pavonis and Claude in Gamma Pavonis explaining the situation. I followed up with messages to Oliver and Mario. Everyone else would get the announcement on the current events RSS feed. Within seconds, several people popped into my VR. This is not according to plan, Claude said. Jacques shrugged. I mentioned this possibility at a mood a while back. Delta is a richer target. A couple of extra years may be a small price to pay for double the payoff, and they know it, seeing the size of the convoy they're sending. Any chance that's because of us? Not a chance, Claude, I said. They don't know we're in that system in the first place, and anyway, it's not like we've done more than buzz around them like a gnat. We are irrelevant. And we will be assimilated. Oliver gave us a lopsided grin. We all chuckled dutifully at the attempt at levity more than anything. Getting down to business, how is our troop buildup? I looked at each person in turn. Jacques spoke first. I've got 20 dreadnoughts, each of which has 5 fission bombs and the usual complement of busters for defense. I've been working on some fusion bombs, but haven't gotten them far enough along, and now we're out of time. Claude jumped in as soon as Jacques was done. I've got 15 dreadnoughts, but I've managed to make a total of 6 fusion bombs to replace some of the fission weapons. I looked at Oliver, who shrugged. I'm building like crazy, old man, but I'm too far away to do any good. I'll send out what I have, and maybe they'll be useful for when the others hit Gamma, assuming they go there next. I looked around at everyone, then shook my head. Another year or two, and we'd have had the cloaking cracked, I'm sure of it. As it is, do what you can. We'll have a mood over the next couple of days, but other than moral support, you guys are on your own. The moot was held within a day. It was a somber affair. When I ascended the podium, all conversation ceased. No air horn, no booze. A sea of faces looked back at me, all wearing the same downcast expression. You all know the situation. Anyone have any ideas?
I don't suppose your asteroid mover could move, Pav. I looked at Thor. It probably hadn't been a serious suggestion.
Sorry, buddy. In theory, the system can move anything, but right now I'd have trouble getting something the size of a planet to budge.
Maybe someday,
if we don't mind the inhabitants freezing to death about midway through the move.
I nodded at Ben, one of the new batch of dreadnoughts.
True. The trip would still take a year or two subjective and all that time spent without a sun. No bueno for sure. I think we're stuck with the situation as it is. It's going to come down to a toe-to-toe punch-up and, unfortunately, before we're ready. The only advantage we have is that we know it's going to happen and they don't.
I looked over my reports. Claude had launched all of his new dreadnoughts to Delta Pavonis. With their better acceleration, they'd arrive before the others, but only just barely. Any strategies would have to be worked out while they were in transit. Between Claude's group and Jacques, we had 35 dreadnoughts. Jacques would probably get that total up to about 60 by the time Claude's group arrived. It sounded like a lot until you looked at the size of the others' force. 20 death asteroids, 40 cargo vessels, and several hundred attendants. The attendants could be considered equivalent to busters. They were almost certainly AIMI-controlled and could be depended upon to ram an enemy if required. The cargo vessels would be difficult to destroy simply because of their size, but I didn't expect a lot of offensive capability there. The death asteroids would be the big unknown. We were pretty confident that we could withstand their death rays, but we really didn't know what other weaponry they might have in reserve. It was a safe bet that the others had thought of the possibility of running into another species capable of fighting back. I mentioned this to Garfield and was surprised when he didn't agree with me.
I think we've visited pretty much every system that the others have been to, Bill. He waved a hand casually at the star map he'd popped up. And they haven't run into anything like that, so they've never had their butts kicked. Even when we've run up against them, the worst we've done is blow ourselves up. They're arrogant. Borg-level arrogant, and maybe even beyond. We're not even assimilation targets to them. We're just food.
I thought about this. So you think they may be overconfident?
I grinned. Or maybe just appropriately confident.
Garfield responded with a rueful chuckle.
Yeah, whatever. The point is, though, they may not have a plan B.
67. Bad news. Howard, December 2210, HIP 14101.
HIP 14101 was a bit of a bust. Nice sun, nice spectral lines, but nothing orbiting it worth talking about. A Jovian had managed to set up shop at the outer edge of the comfort zone, leaving no space for any terrestrial planets. I was having a good time investigating it, though. According to WikiBob, no one had yet given a gas giant anything more than the standard cursory once-over. Okay, granted, they're hard to colonize, but still. Adapting the drones to operate inside the atmosphere of the Jovian was a constant headache, a game of whack-a-mole, as original Bob would have said. I would get a little deeper in with each new prototype, but I was losing about 1 in 3. But there was lots of metal in this system, and I had all the time in the world. I was relaxing out on the patio when a ding indicated an incoming message. I popped it up and started to read. It was another update from Dexter. More about the colonies, several new cities, population up over 1 million, space industries, yada yada. Oh. Stefan was dying. Halliburton's encephalopathy had been identified within a decade of landing on Vulcan and appeared to be one of the few diseases that found Terran life compatible. There was no treatment yet, and it was fatal within 6 months. I felt my stomach drop away. Stefan had been my friend for a long time, and the thing with Bridget hadn't changed that. Not really. But it reminded me that I called humans ephemerals for a reason. I'd been lounging around in this system for too long. First, I wrote an email to Bridget and Stefan and asked when I could arrange a call. Then, there would be other calls to make. I pinged Bill, then popped in when I got an acknowledgement. Garfield was there as well, sitting and drinking a coffee.
Diagrams and notes covered all the walls. Just your basic normal mad scientist lab. Both of them looked down in the dumps. All the Bobs were preparing for the other's arrival in Delta Pavonis. Bill and Garfield no doubt felt pressure to produce new weapons, but you could only do what you could do. Well, I sympathized, but I had immediate concerns. "Hey, guys," I said, motioning to the decorations. "What's the project?" "Couple of different ones," Garfield answered. "But most of this wall is the Android project. That's what you called about, right?" I nodded and examined my shoes for a few moments before looking up. "How close are you guys to a more or less human-equivalent android? I'm going to have a funeral to attend soon." Bill and Garfield looked at each other, then back at me. "Pretty far along, actually. We've got a prototype. It looks like a mannequin, and you wouldn't want to go dancing, but for walking around, I think it's ready." "Could I make one in 3 months?" Bill thought for a few moments. "Right now it's all prototypes and one-offs with manual assembly. We'd have to put together formal printer plans. But once we have those done, yes." I nodded. "It would be in time." You never knew for sure with medical predictions, of course, but one could hope. "Send the plans to Dexter at Vulcan when they're ready, okay?" I'd received an email from Dexter that the android was ready. It was time to arrange a visit. I took a deep breath and placed a phone call. After a few rings, Bridget answered the phone.
"Howard?"
"Hi, Bridge. How's Stefan doing?" Bridget hesitated. She looked terrible. Stefan's illness was taking its toll on her as well. Her eyes were red. Her hair was gray. Her skin was gray. I wanted to take her in my arms and make it all go away, and I realized with a start, this was the first time that I had articulated my feelings about her so clearly.
"Stefan won't last much longer. Another couple of weeks is the most the doctors will commit to."
"I'm so sorry, Bridget. How's he taking it?"
"He's mostly not lucid anymore, Howard. We knew that was coming. And we said our goodbyes."
She blinked back tears as she spoke. Brave words, but the pain behind them shone through. I endured a momentary wave of grief as I realized I wouldn't be able to say goodbye to my friend. I looked at Bridget without saying anything, and she nodded, understanding completely. I tried to say the usual inane words of encouragement. I would have stayed on the line as long as she wanted, but she was tired, physically and emotionally, and she soon begged off. I hung up the phone and put my face in my hands. It took several milliseconds to get myself under control. Then I pinged Dexter. "Hi, Howard. Checking up on Manny?" "Yep." I looked around Dexter's VR. It was a basic library sort of thing. I'd begun to notice less and less effort by the Bobs, especially the later generations, to put together an interesting VR. I made a mental note to discuss the shift in attitudes with Dexter if the opportunity ever came up. He nodded and popped up a video and some report summaries. The video showed Manny the android in his support cradle. He looked complete. I leaned forward and looked closely at the summary windows. "All tests completed successfully," Dexter said. "I figured you'd want to do the first activation." "Thanks, Dex." Bill's android project had been going on and off for 65 years now, and this was the latest version. Manny consisted of a carbon fiber matrix skeleton designed and articulated to replicate the human version as closely as possible. Memory plastics that contracted when a voltage was applied stood in for muscles. The artificial musculature was laid down over the skeleton in the same layout as human musculature. The result was something that should be able to move, behave, and appear realistic. And neural feedback from the android would ensure a realistic experience for the operator. Unfortunately, human-appearing skin and hair were low on the priority list. Right now, Manny did indeed resemble a mannequin more than anything else. No hair, pale plastic texture skin, and gray, staring eyes. According to the specs, facial muscle control was still a little spotty. I had a quick glance at the deficiencies list. Well, Bill had said it was a prototype. 68. Recording. Jacques, September 2212, Delta Pavonis. Guppy popped into VR.
New memory core is online.
Good, it was getting a little tight. Have the drones resume the full program. Guppy nodded and disappeared. I had implemented a plan to record as much of the planet as I could before the others got here. Not just PAV civilization either. Plants, animals, scenery, geology, anything and everything I could think of. I built a standalone set of stasis chambers well in advance of the colony ships, and now I was slowly stocking it with genetic material from every species that I could get a needle into. A very informal and ad hoc genetic diversity vault, in essence. I had no overall organization, as I'd had no time to catalog and categorize the life on Delta Pavonis IV into any kind of system. I was, in effect, stealing a strategy from NOAA and treating everything as a kind. The recordings would help with identifying species and such later. If there was a later. I was also recording PAV societies, cultures, and languages. Between all the spying and recording, my data storage requirements were massive. Guppy had just done the third upgrade since I'd started the project. I estimated there was at least one more upgrade coming. I had played with the idea of contacting some PAV on the sly, perhaps to get a personal account of life, but Bill had convinced me that it would be cruel at best and at worst, ghoulish. Instead, I operated as a passive observer. Our technology was much better than the Victorian-era PAV sciences, but even so, things didn't always go perfectly. There'd been a couple of sightings, and PAV society now had their own version of conspiracy theorists and flying saucer nuts. It made me wonder if the human equivalents had been based on some kind of reality. I tried to imagine some alien version of replicants hanging around Earth and kidnapping people. No. Especially with the anal probe thing. Just no. Since the plan involved kidnapping 20,000 PAV, I wanted to have a pre-selected target group. Running around grabbing people until I hit my quota just didn't strike me as efficient. I spent some time doing a census of small towns until I had found two that came in just under 10,000 souls each. I could, if necessary, top up the numbers from what appeared to be nearby military bases. The two towns, Mirshkva and Izilkva, were like small-town USA, rural, residential, stable population, family-oriented. I wanted to document and understand PAV society at the grassroots level. On the other hand, I didn't want to go down the road of Bob One and end up getting attached to individuals. I had a bad feeling, though, that we Bobs had a shared weakness of some kind, some need for attachment. It would require a delicate balancing act. I picked a house at random in the town of Mirchkva and set up surveillance. Nat-sized roamers installed cameras and microphones in the house. I felt dirty, like some kind of voyeur, but reminded myself that I was preserving the record of a culture that would likely not exist in another decade. The Los family group seemed fairly average, as PAV families went. Six adults split evenly between the genders, plus nine children at various ages. The PAV didn't have a large need for privacy, so bedroom organization was based mostly on available space. Furniture tended to move around on a daily basis, depending on mood.
Meals were held at specific times, simply because of the logistics of preparing food for that many people, but there was no organization that I could see.
My best metaphor was a birthday party attended by two-year-olds, a total free-for-all. The adults held an assortment of jobs. The PAV didn't seem to care about stratification of social classes. The matriarch of the house, Da Hazjarlos, was on Mirkva's town council. She seemed intelligent and, for a PAV, very level-headed. I made a point of tagging her for special handling, if and when. I settled in for some long-term spying on people's lives.
69. Wake. Howard, January 2211, Vulcan.
Okay, here goes.
This was the third time I'd said that, but I still hadn't opened the cargo bay door. Stage fright for sure. Manny would never be mistaken for human. He was a giant step down from Mr. Data, in fact, but I had told Bridget I would be there, and I was going to keep my promise. I took a deep breath. Manny performed the motion, not that he needed oxygen, and commanded the door to open. I stepped out and looked around. I had landed the cargo drone in the parking lot of the funeral home. A small crowd of people was gathered in front of the building entrance, watching. I guess they'd been waiting for me. I activated magnification for a moment and recognized several people, including Butterworth. I walked toward the group, concentrating on not falling flat on my face. I'd practiced beforehand, but this was my first physical public appearance in almost 200 years. Nervous didn't even begin to cover it. Butterworth nodded to me.
Not bad, Howard. I'm sure you'll continue to improve the product.
I nodded back. There wasn't enough facial control to smile yet, and I didn't trust my voice right at that moment. We stepped into the building where Bridget was waiting. She smiled, and my heart was almost wrenched out of my chest at the sadness there. She'd been with Stefan for 18 years. She stepped up to me and said,
Howard, I'm glad you came. Can I hug you?
Yes, of course. Manny has full sensory input. It'll be my first real hug since I, died. Wow, almost a total foot-in-mouth moment. Since I became a replicant. She wrapped her arms around me and hugged. And I could feel every bit of it. From her head against my cheek, to her breasts against my chest, to her arms around my back. The moment lasted an eternity and a fraction of a second. Bridget stepped back and looked into my eyes, and I tried to re-engage my brain. I finally managed. It's good to see you. A small panicked corner of my mind wondered if Manny had faithfully rendered my imitation of a fish trying to breathe. I hoped not. I looked towards the coffin. I guess replication wasn't an option.
Catholic, remember?
Bridget gave me a wan smile.
I don't think the Archbishop would approve.
I wanted to ask if she would reconsider it for herself, but this wasn't the time or place. This was the memorial. The funeral mass had already been held, and I hadn't actually forgotten that Stefan was Catholic. I would have been a distraction, to put it mildly. Bridget had been careful with who she invited to this event to prevent any kind of awkwardness with yours truly. We stood around and talked, compared memories. I met Bridget's children, Rosie, Leanne, and Howard, who answered to Howie. He would have just turned 13 by the old Earth calendar and seemed uncomfortable with his height, as if he'd just been through a growth spurt. Howie bombarded me with questions while the two girls stood behind him and looked on with wide eyes. Turned out Stefan had told stories about me. I told Howie a few stories about his father. As I did, memories of our early days on Vulcan flooded back. Stefan had always accepted me as just a guy he talked to on the phone a lot. There'd never been any awkwardness, any reserve. It hit me that he was the best friend I'd had since well before I died. I scheduled a good cry for later when I was alone. Bridget came over to stand beside me, a plate of food in her hand. I looked down at it, the usual mix of hors d'oeuvres, meat slices, and crackers. Bridget saw my glance and asked,
Can you eat?
Not yet. Bill's going to engineer Manny to be as human-like as possible, eventually. He's been distracted with the others thing, though. I'll eat something in VR. Bridget looked at her children, at her plate, everywhere but at me. I knew the conversation we'd had before I left Vulcan was still hanging there between us. I sighed and experienced a moment of panic when I realized that the sigh was audible.
We'll talk some other time. You're not leaving right after the memorial, are you?
Bridget had a small smile on her face. Physically, I'm about 19 light years away, Bridget. Scut remote capability is making distance mostly irrelevant. Manny will go into storage when I'm done with him, so there's no leaving as such. I'll always be around, whether by phone or in person, so to speak. I looked around.
The two girls had wandered off, but Howie was glued to our conversation.
How'd it go?
Bill's posture reminded me of Bridget, the day we introduced our product to Butterworth. I guess I should have expected it. This was a potentially watershed moment for the Bobs. Real physical contact would change all of our interactions. Bill and Garfield had both popped in as soon as I came back to VR. Dexter was there as resident Bob.